I'm going to ask you what you think of this reading. You know, we're taking a very we're taking a turn into a new aspect. Uh-oh. That's Britta's right voicemail. Okay. Bye-bye. Okay.
Hi, Britta. We tried to call you.
Okay.
I find it very welcoming. A part of the impatience that I sometimes have with the deconstructing of the conventional is that it doesn't offer another way of seeing, or another way of knowing, and I appreciate the presentation of a vision so that there's some other way to know.
Yeah, I think that's good. I mean, it's a good point. I think that it's one of the characteristics. You know, each of the TSK books is very different. And Love of Knowledge is very patient, it seems to me, but that means it requires us to be patient as well. You know, there is an understanding or an analysis, and as I said in the orientation, it's an analysis that uses conventional knowledge, if you want to put it that way. So there's this very careful taking apart of the things that we accept as being so. And I don't know if it's we as Westerners, but you know, we have a tendency to say, well, okay, let's assume you're right. What do I do about it? You know, we want to cut to the chase. We want to find out what the appropriate response is. And what I suggested in the orientation was that there is a point to doing that kind of analysis because it kind of opens up the field of inquiry, you know. Now we're ready to do inquiry, but if we just jumped into it, I mean, we could do that, you know, and sometimes when I've talked from Love of Knowledge, it's not as though I always make people go from the beginning. You can kind of jump in. But by doing a more careful analysis like this, you create more opportunities, I think, when you actually get to the point of inquiry. But now we're at the point of inquiry, so we get to, relax and enjoy it, or as you were saying, it's kind of welcoming, inviting. Anybody else have any comments about, you know, where we are right now and how that's been, how you've been experiencing that, in either in reading or in you know, applying some of what we've been talking about? Anybody want to say anything?
Michael?
Yeah.
I always start off the reading with the desire to master it and to be able to apply it. And then, like this chapter in particular, I can never do that, especially if I try to combine the reading with the exercise 5, but they seem both to be aiming at the same thing. I always end up feeling, every time I sit down and read it, it's like it's new. A lot of it's like, almost as if I hadn't read it before. And that seems very in line with the message of, I mean, I would love to take a position, namely of mastery of material, and I'm unable to, so I'm obliged to just keep positioning myself in an attempt to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's good too. I certainly have the same experience, you know. As you know, was involved in the editing of this book, so I worked very intensively with the material. It was quite a while ago, and I've taught it a lot since then, but it's always new. Whenever I come back to it, it's almost as though, it's not as though I haven't read it before. That's not quite right. I've read it before, but it's a reminder, or it's more than a reminder. It's the invitation is always new. Maybe that's the way to say it. And
I think somebody else could have written that book and you would end up thinking, oh, now I understand a new way of looking at the world. And
mm-hmm.
Love of Knowledge doesn't let me do that.
Right.
So I have to keep I have to keep reading if I want to remain in a relationship to the ideas of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one of the characteristics of TSK one of the things that, you know, to be honest, has made it difficult, I think, to find the right audience for TSK is that it doesn't give you that sense of mastery. It's not written for the sake of the self. You know, you can't say, when you finish reading this book, you will understand such and such. In a way, you can say that, but it's deeply misleading because the self is not going to have some new understanding. You know, the kind of knowledge that opens up is not going to be the self's knowledge. And, you know, we don't even know what that means. I mean, the book in part is trying to tell us, but it's very difficult to really get a sense of what that means. So we keep coming back to it. And, certainly in terms of the experience of working with the book, there's something really quite lovely about that because, it's a gift that is given to us again and again and again. And even, you know, I don't know what your experience is like, but, you know, yesterday I was preparing for this phone call and going through the chapter. And then today I was reviewing the chapter and reviewing my preparation, and they were two completely different experiences. And as you said, Michael, that's a kind of a characteristic of the TSK writings. So I hope people are enjoying that or finding it welcoming. Yes, yes.
Is that also the nature of experience?
Well, that's a good point. Sure, sure. Yeah, it's not as though we get to have this special TSK moment. What TSK is showing us, or what Rinpoche is trying to point out, is exactly that. That's a really good point. That freshness is always available to us. Somebody said to me yesterday, someone who's a student of a different teacher said something that I thought was kind of striking and is similar to TSK. She said, when I see somebody, I always try to greet them as though I were meeting them for the first time. And when I leave them, I always try to leave them as though I'm never going to see them again. And that has some of that flavor, the TSK flavor, that each moment has a kind of its own special aliveness. And of course, taking a position is exactly the opposite of that. Taking a position is trying to freeze that aliveness, so that we have something to work with, you know, so that the self has its raw material. There's I don't think I want to go too far into this, but there's a Western political theorist, Hannah Arendt, who writes about the difference in one of her books between making and doing. Making and acting. Her argument is that in our culture, we try to set things up so that we're making. Or doing, you know, the self as doer, the self as maker, the technological self, if you want to say it that way, you know, kind of bringing it back to TSK. Whereas acting, she says, it stands in a completely different relationship to time, where you're always creating yourself anew. So, you know, her argument is that the ancient Greeks had understood something about acting that we've lost. And I don't know if that's true. You know, I don't know if her argument is correct, but the distinction is an interesting one. It goes exactly in this direction. It because it has to do with time. And she actually says, every action is a new beginning. So if we're ready to act in the world, rather than making a world or making sense of the world, then I think that's much more in the spirit of TSK. Anybody else have any comments about this kind of approach? This, you know, Rinpoche refers to it in this chapter as, or maybe it was the last chapter, as free and open inquiry. And that's a very nice word, term. Anybody else want to say anything about that, that kind of inquiry that we're now really starting to turn to and work with?
A couple comments, Jack.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. We can comment? Okay. Okay. So Tina's comment, we can just leave that be. That's great. Okay. So Karen says that it wasn't so easy. I mean, reading the text, I suppose that's true. You know, you read the text and you say, oh, I see. Now I understand how to do it. And then you try to do it, and in fact what happens is that you get sucked back into your positions, maybe. But there is that possibility. There's always that possibility. So, looking through the fog, hard to stay with the inquiry. I'm just looking at Karin's comment. Yes, maybe. And of course, I think the response to that is to say, well, you know, then there's the fog. The fog of not knowing, and that's the experience to look at. So you don't try to penetrate it necessarily. It's just in that moment that becomes where you look. And Q's comment is similar. You need to, yes, what you write is correct, Q. You need to let go of your conventional thinking. I don't know about knowing through a different system. The word system is always a little bit problematic in TSK. But directness is right, and a kind of not grasping is right. Well, why don't we look at some specific examples. Last week we were talking about an emotional situation as an example. And I thought that we could use that as an example again. Suppose you have a situation where you are angry, right? So somebody has said something and, accusing you of something or whatever, and you feel angry. So there's a whole situation there. There's the feeling of anger. There's the cause of the feeling. You know very clearly you're angry because that person said something, right? There's the situation in the sense that, you know, there's the self that's angry. There's the one who made you feel angry. There's the explanation, and there's the feeling. And there's more going on, but that's kind of a sense, gives us a sense of the whole structure. So, the inquiry here, it seems to me, is not trying to explain your anger, not even, at least not completely, just trying to feel the anger, you know, which would be more kind of a meditative, instruction. It's more to inhabit that situation fully. It's not the story that you're telling about it. It's an inquiry within the situation. So it's as though each part of that situation is open to inquiry, is available in a new way. And you don't, that doesn't mean you have to go through and look at this part, the person who made me angry, and then look at this part, the feeling of anger. And, you know, you might try exploring that. You might do it that way as a style of inquiry. But the basic inquiry is more just within the situation to ask about the situation, to ask the question, what's going on? And not to give an answer. Because if you give an answer, then you've moved away from the situation into the answer. You've taken a position, right? So if somebody were to ask you what's going on, then you and you you know, and you wanted to answer them, then you would have to take a position, you'd have to describe what was going on, and in doing that, you would move away from the situation. And of course, that's one reason why sometimes, you know, if we're really involved doing something, if we're engaged in a task, and somebody comes in and wants to know what's happening, we don't want to break out of it. We say, you know, I can't talk now, I'm doing this. Because the talking will take us out of it. But what happens is that we always do tell ourselves what's going on. We always do have this story. And sometimes we don't understand what's going on, and then we try to investigate, we try to analyze it in ordinary terms. But the analysis that we're talking about here, the free and open inquiry, is just the openness within the situation. It's a kind of a, you know, I mean, there's some simple ways of talking about that, but I think that the analysis in TSK is, you know, opens that up in a really wonderful way. But you know, in a simple way, you'd say just looking with fresh eyes, you know, or looking with beginner's mind, you know. But you look at the whole situation, and that's one of the reasons we've done this previous analysis, is this, so that we see how much of the situation is how much there is in the situation. So you could think of it in terms of the intentional knowledge component, the descriptive knowledge component, maybe the polar or perceptual knowledge component. But there's a whole lot. There's a whole lot going on, and all of it is available for free and open inquiry. So, you know, there's a model in neuroscience, I guess, in the Western understanding of how the mind works, or that says the purpose of consciousness is to simplify things. To, and, you know, in a way it says the whole purpose of consciousness is to label things so that we don't have to pay attention to them. Because if we had to pay attention to everything that we were seeing, or experiencing is a better word, we'd be overloaded. You know, there's just too much going on in any moment. So, you know, one way of saying that is that the purpose of consciousness is to reduce what we experience.
To organize.
Yeah, to organize it, that's one aspect of it, definitely. But you know, I'm thinking more about the labeling aspect.
Organize and label.
Yeah, good. Organize and label, and then in a sense discard. You know, you can kind of throw it away.
What becomes known.
Right. And what's known, you have to be careful how we say this, what is already known is something that we no longer know. If you understand, you know, if you see what I mean. Because what we know at that point is just the label, and we've lost the experience. And in fact, that's what's happening. We're living in the world of labels. So there's a, I wanted to give you an analogy for that, or a simile, I guess, something that I saw once in India quite a few years ago. I went into the phone company in India, and the phone company was also the telegraph company. So there were all these people sending telegrams. This was before the internet, you know, so I don't know, it was maybe 15 years ago, I don't remember exactly. And, you know, probably there's still more people who use the telegraph company than here. But anyway, when you walk into the telegraph company, there's a great big sign over the counter where you go to place your telegram, I guess it is, yeah, where you go to send your telegram. And it took me a while to figure out what it was, but then I realized what it was. On this sign, there were a lot of messages, which were the kind of messages that you would send if you were sending a telegram. So, you know, things like congratulations on your wedding, or condolences on your loss. You know, the kinds of things that people typically send telegrams for. And each one of them had a number. And I realized what was going on was instead of sending a telegram which says, congratulations on your wedding, which is, what, four words, and there's a per word charge, you just send the number 67. And so you saved all that money. So somebody, I don't know how it worked at the other end, whether somebody got a telegram that just said 67, and then they looked it up. Yeah, but you know, that's a kind of an interesting simile for how the mind works. You know, we can just apply the label. We just tell ourselves, oh, 67, you know, and then we know. And so it's like, you know, the kind of example, I think we talked about this once in here, just seeing a tree, for instance. You know, you don't really see the tree. You see it for a moment. You see it long enough to apply the label. And then you can toss it away because it's there. It's taken care of. And now you turn to something else. So the model in the West is, and I'm not saying this is the only model, but I think people, Western scientists tend to kind of accept this way of thinking of it, is that, the purpose of consciousness is to do that kind of labeling so that we can use our precious mental resources in other ways. You know, we don't have to constantly really be experiencing everything. We can ignore everything in favor of the labels that we apply and then just look around, you know, for whatever it is that might be dangerous or might be food or, you know, there's this kind of very simplistic version of what it is that human beings are about based on the idea of survival. You know, so we're looking out for things that might be dangerous or we're looking out for things that might help us survive. And that's basically it. You know, it's kind of a scientific model. So you ignore most things. So that's the argument that's made about what consciousness is like, and the idea is that we can't do it any other way. Because it just takes too much, it would take too much of our mental resources. But, you know, what's interesting, what's left out in that model is the idea that we are originally aware, right? All of that awareness is flooding in. Now, usually we tend to think in terms of perceptual awareness. You know, if I look around at my desk is pretty cluttered at the moment. It's mostly, sadly, in a sense, I'm surrounded by machines, you know. I have my phone and my printer and my computer and a second computer screen and a scanner. That's what I'm surrounded by. and my mouse and then the top of the desk and then the wall opposite me and a lamp and so on. So the world around me is very, very cluttered, very, very full. And I'm just not noticing any of that. Well, maybe that's not so terrible. Maybe it would be a good thing if we were tuned in, you know, in some sense aware of all of it. But certainly, there's a lot going on beyond the perceptual situation. You know, there's my feeling and my mood, and of course there's the fact that, you know, we're having this phone conversation. There's all of these things happening that are really drawing on a different kind of knowledge. And the point here, it seems to me, is that even if we accept as kind of a definition that consciousness is the part that has the job of labeling everything and organizing everything so that we can then ignore it, there is another aspect to awareness. And that yes. Yes.
I think we could clean that up.
Okay.
If instead of saying that was the job of consciousness, mm-hmm. we said that was ego function.
Okay.
So if we say the ego function, now we're not talking about ego as entity, we're talking about function,
mm-hmm.
is mm-hmm. to organize and interpret.
Yeah.
And we don't label that consciousness, we call that ego function or self function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that might be a better term. I don't like taking a word that is potentially very rich, like consciousness, and just limiting it to that one function. The other approach would be to say, well, let's call this broader concept, I guess in the meditative tradition, or you might say awareness. In TSK, there's a perfectly good word for this broader function. which is one that Rinpoche has made up, and I don't know if we've encountered it in Love of Knowledge yet, and that's knowingness.
Yeah, right? That works.
But in any event, we're trying to move out of this. We can call it ego function. I do like that better than consciousness. Maybe in the end it's not the best choice, but for now, that's fine. So we have, maybe we should just call it ordinary knowledge. Maybe that fits better with the TSK way of talking. So we have ordinary knowledge, and we're trying to move to something else that we're calling knowingness. And what I've been trying to lay out here is just another way of making that distinction between our ordinary way of knowing and knowingness. But that really is what the chapter is about, too. And what Rinpoche says again and again and again when he's doing this kind of analysis, but he finds, you know, some very wonderful, I think, and illuminating ways of saying it, is that we question everything that's going on. And we don't question it in the sense of saying, well, I don't believe that. Or, you know, that must be a mistaken view. We don't question it in the sense of challenging in that sense. We question it in the sense of asking, what is it? You know, at one point, Rinpoche says, in this chapter, he says, we investigate, let's see if I can find it here, I think it's at the top of page 274, yeah, in the first full paragraph, maybe let's read that whole paragraph, because I think it makes the point very nicely. He says, the kind of inquiry we're talking about, he called it an observation without friction, at the very top of page 274. He says, such an inquiry rejects the bystander's claim to be the one that knows. So that would be the ego function that fits very nicely with that. And sets up no new knower in its place. What is known through inquiry is not something new known by someone. This interpretation would only go beyond the existing structure, thus affirming the structure itself. So, you know, you could say affirming the structure, or you could say setting up a new structure, going beyond the old structure to some new structure. I think either way of thinking about it is fine. Instead, free and open inquiry sees through the truth of what the bystander knows. And when Rinpoche uses the word through here, this has come up in a couple of other places in the readings, I think he's playing on two meanings of the word through. One is to see through in the sense of looking to the other side, like you look through a piece of glass to see what's happening on the other side of the piece of glass, right? So you see through it. And in English, when we say we've seen through something, we also often mean it's claiming to be one thing, but we see through it and we see what it really is. You know, we see through your false promises, or that way of talking about it. So that's one aspect of through. The other way, through means by means of. And I think that's equally important, right? Free and open inquiry sees through the truth of what the bystander knows. It's by knowing with the knowing that we already have, we discover the knowingness. Now, in a part of Love of Knowledge that we won't be reading, the part four of the book, if you want to read it, Rinpoche spends quite a bit of time analyzing the nature of that ness. Literally, he talks about the ness. But for our purposes right now, we can say that seeing through the knowing, the ordinary knowing, leads us to the knowingness, the kind of more fundamental knowing that grounds everything. Right? So, going back to that paragraph, free and open inquiry sees through the truth of what the bystander knows, investigating how that truth is set up without setting up a competing truth. So that was actually where I wanted to get us to, was that question of investigating how the truth is set up. And again, I think it's important to understand that in the right way, and to look carefully at the language, or to think through the language a little bit. Sometimes when you ask about how, you say, well, how did it happen? You know, how could you have made that mistake? Something like that. What you're asking for is actually the cause. You're asking for the why. You know, what were the steps that led up to this? And I don't think that's the primary thing that Rinpoche is talking about. There may be room for that. I mean, there may be a way of looking at that, because the causal stories that we tell are part of the situation. So we may want to look at that. But I think here, when he says how the truth is set up, it's much more in terms of the image I was thinking of is a piece of machinery. You know, if you have some very complicated piece of machinery, and you just want to know how does it work, and what you do is you trace it, you trace all the parts. Quite some years ago, I worked on a piece of machinery in our bindery where we print Tibetan texts, you know, and it was the gold stamper. It stamped the cover of each book with a gold stamp. And it was really a nice piece of machinery. I'm not a very mechanical guy, but I really enjoyed working on this, at least when it worked well. It tended to break down a lot. The reason I liked it, and I can't describe it, you know, it's not worth describing it very well or very in much detail, but it had all these different parts, you know. But it would take the cover, and there was this suction that sucked it into place, and then there was the other part of the machine which, you know, took the metal plate that was going to stamp it and moved it forward. And what it felt like, or what it looked like really, was that there were all these little men, at least that's how I thought about it, all these little men playing their roles, and it was like a little, in front of me, it was this little factory with, you know, 50 different men, each one of whom had a different role. Of course, actually, it was just a little piece of machinery. But it was really fun to see how it worked, you know, to see how that particular process operates. And I think that that's more a sense of what we really want to be looking at. Now, we tend to think all of that happens too quickly for us to really notice it. You know, let's say you're angry, and so you would like to ask, well, how does this being angry work? You know, how is it set up? And in a way, all of that happens before we notice it. You know, we notice, by the time we notice it, we're already angry. So we don't necessarily have the opportunity to see, you know, some initial reaction, and then, you know, somebody says something to us and we react, and there's a feeling in the body, and it moves up through the body, let's say. Rinpoche in other books writes about this kind of thing. There's a kind of a tightness in the belly or maybe in the throat, and then it spreads through the body, and then, you know, and then there's this feeling of anger. So that's a very simple version of seeing the how it happened, that causal part that we were talking about before. And that may be too quick for us to notice it. But if you look at the how of the anger, you say, what's going on? You know, maybe one of the things you notice is in fact that feeling, that tightness in the belly or the throat. And when you begin to notice it, maybe it shifts in some way. So part of what we're talking about is you don't need to be really, really quick. You know, you don't need to grab or take hold of the experience before it fully forms. Because just being in the situation already gives you plenty to investigate. You know, already lets you move past the story or the label into the actual experience of what's going on. So that's, I think, part of the distinction here. But there is also another element, and we're just not really going to have time to talk about it. But it's the very end of the, it's what comes up at the very end of the chapter, and I referred to it last time too, and said we'd talk about it, but we're not going to. Sorry. And that is the sense of timing that goes with this. You know, part of what is involved in every situation, it's not just the world out there and the self in here that's experiencing and the connection between the two. It's also how time unfolds and how space supports that kind of experience. And when we come to the conclusion that time, that everything moves too quickly, and that's kind of behind what I was just calling the scientific model before. I said, we can't, the idea is that you can't possibly take in all the experience because everything's moving too quickly, so you've got to judge, you've got to choose. And that's true if you're working with a certain understanding of time. If your understanding of time is different, if it's deeper, let's say, that limitation may not operate in the same way. You may be able to, going to that level of knowingness is also going to a different level of time. And that's suggested at the end of this chapter. But it's only kind of hinted at, and we're not going to have time to talk about it. So that's the way it is. So once again, we didn't talk about exercise 5. My apologies. There was a reference to it, so I'm off the hook a little bit. But maybe during the, I would suggest during the week, part of what will help us break through this sense of ordinary knowing, because it's so closely bound to the idea of the self or the ego function, if you want to say that, the ego function of knowing, part of what will help us break through that is just to be able to explore the self as a part of how everything is set up. It's set up so that there's a self that knows. There's a bystander who's having the experience. That's basically what exercise 5 is about. I'm also going to mention in the orientation for next week's reading, we're skipping, I think, a whole chapter. We go to page 291, is that right? Reading for next week is pages 291 to 294, which is, double check here, one moment. It actually is in the middle, it's a section in the middle of chapter 35. So it's not the beginning of chapter 5.
What page is it?
291 to 294. It's on the website, but so it's the, 291. That section starts, the heading there is Boundless Realms of Knowing. So that's the reading, but I also will be suggesting that you work with the exercise at the end of the chapter, exercise 35. That's on 295. So, we'll have to stop there for today.